Wooly. The funny thing about a story, thought Wooly, while Emmett was in town and Duchess was on a walk and Billy was reading aloud from his big red book, the funny thing about a story is that it can be told in all sorts of lengths. The first time Wooly heard The Count of Monte Cristo, he must have been younger than Billy. His family was spending the summer at the camp in the Adirondacks, and every night his sister Sarah would read him a chapter before he went to bed. But what his sister was reading from was the original book by Alexandre Dumas, which was 1,000 pages long. The thing about hearing a story like The Count of Monte Cristo from the 1,000-page version is that whenever you sense an exciting part is coming, you have to wait and wait and wait for it to actually arrive. In fact, sometimes you have to wait so long for it to arrive, you forget that it's coming altogether and let yourself drift off to sleep. But in Billy's big red book, Professor Abernathy had chosen to tell the entire story over the course of 8 pages. So in his version, when you sensed an exciting part was coming, it arrived lickety-split. Like the part that Billy was reading now. The part when Edmond Dantès, convicted of a crime he didn't commit, is carted off to spend the rest of his life in the dreaded Château d'If. Even as he is being led in chains through the prison's formidable gates, you just know that Dantès is bound to escape. But in Mr. Dumas' telling, before he regains his freedom, you have to listen to so many sentences spread across so many chapters that it begins to feel like you are the one who is in the Château d'If. Not so with Professor Abernathy. In his telling, the hero's arrival at the prison, his 8 years of solitude, his friendship with the Abbé Faria, and his miraculous escape all occur on the very same page. Wooly pointed at the solitary cloud that was passing overhead. That's what I imagine the Château d'If looked like. Carefully marking his place with his finger, Billy looked up to where Wooly was pointing and readily agreed. With its straight rock walls and the watchtower in the middle. Wooly and Billy both smiled to see it, but then Billy's expression grew rather more serious. Can I ask you a question, Wooly? Of course, of course. Was it hard to be at Salina? As Wooly considered the question, far overhead the Château d'If transformed itself into an ocean liner, with a giant smokestack where the watchtower once had been. No, said Wooly. It wasn't so hard, Billy. Certainly not like the Château d'If was for Edmond Dantès. It's just that every day at Salina was an everyday day. What's an everyday day, Wooly? Wooly took another moment to consider. When we were at Salina, every day we would get up at the same time and get dressed in the same clothes. Every day we had breakfast at the same table with the same people. And every day we did the same work in the same fields before going to sleep at the same hour in the same beds. Though Billy was just a boy, or maybe because he was just a boy, he seemed to understand that while there is nothing wrong with waking up or getting dressed or having breakfast per se, there is something fundamentally disconcerting about doing these things in the exact same fashion, day in and day out, especially in the 1,000-page version of one's own life. After nodding, Billy found his place and began to read again. What Wooly did not have the heart to tell Billy was that while this was unquestionably the way of life at Salina, it was also the way of life in many other places. It was certainly the way of life at boarding school, and not simply at St. George's, where Wooly had most recently been enrolled. At all 3 boarding schools that Wooly had attended, every day they would wake up at the same time, get dressed in the same clothes, and have breakfast at the same table with the same people before heading off to attend the same classes in the same classrooms. Wooly had often wondered about that. Why did the heads of boarding schools choose to make every day an everyday day? After some reflection, he came to suspect that they did so because it made things easier to manage. By turning every day into an everyday day, The cook would always know when to cook breakfast, the history teacher when to teach history, and the hall monitor when to monitor the halls. But then Wooly had an epiphany. It was in the first semester of his second junior year, the one at St. Mark's. On his way from physics down to the gymnasium, he happened to notice the dean of students getting out of a taxi in front of the schoolhouse. As soon as he saw the taxi, it occurred to Wooly what a pleasant surprise it would be were he to pay a visit to his sister, who had recently bought a big white house in Hastings-on-Hudson. So jumping in the back of the cab, Wooly gave the address.
"You mean in New York?"
the driver asked in surprise.
"I mean in New York," Wooly confirmed.
And off they went. When he arrived a few hours later, Wooly found his sister in the kitchen on the verge of peeling a potato.
"Hello, sis."
Were Wooly to pay a surprise visit to any other member of his family, they would probably have greeted him with an absolute slew of who's, why's, and what's, especially when he needed $150 for the taxi driver who was waiting outside. But after paying the driver, Sarah just put the kettle on the stove, some cookies on a plate, and the two of them had a grand old time, sitting at her table and discussing all the various topics that happened to pop into their heads. But after an hour or so, Wooly's brother-in-law, Dennis, walked through the kitchen door. Wooly's sister was 7 years older than Wooly, and Dennis was 7 years older than Sarah. So mathematically speaking, Dennis had been 32 at the time. But Dennis was also 7 years older than himself, which made him almost 40 in spirit. That is why, no doubt, he was already a vice president at J.P. Morgan & Sons & Company. When Dennis discovered Wooly at the kitchen table, he was a little upset on the grounds that Wooly was supposed to be someplace else. But he was even more upset when he discovered the half-peeled potato on the counter. "When is dinner?" he asked Sarah. "I'm afraid I haven't started preparing it yet." "But it's 7:30. "Oh, for heaven's sake, Dennis." For a moment, Dennis looked at Sarah in disbelief. Then he turned to Wooly and asked if he could speak to Sarah in private. In Wooly's experience, when someone asks if they can speak to someone else in private, it is difficult to know what to do with yourself. For one thing, they generally don't tell you how long they're going to be, so it's hard to know how deeply you should involve yourself in some new endeavor. Should you take the opportunity to visit the washroom? Or start a jigsaw puzzle that depicts a sailboat race with 50 spinnakers? And how far should you go? You certainly need to go far enough so that you can't hear them talking. That was the whole point of their asking you to leave in the first place. But it often sounds like they may want you to come back a bit later, so you need to be close enough to hear them when they call. Doing his best to split the hair down the muddle, Wooly went into the living room, where he discovered an unplayed piano and some unread books and an unwound grandfather clock, which, come to think of it, was very aptly named since it once had belonged to their grandfather. But as it turned out, given how upset Dennis had become, the living room wasn't far enough away, because Wooly could hear every word.
"You were the one who wanted to move out of the city," Dennis was saying, "but I'm the one who has to get up at the crack of dawn in order to catch the 6:42 so that I can be at the bank in time for the investment committee meeting at 8. For most of the next 10 hours, while you're here doing God knows what, I am working like a dog. And if I run to Grand Central and I'm lucky enough to catch the 6:14, I just might make it home by 7:30. After a day like that, is it really so much to ask that you have dinner waiting on the table?"
That's the moment the epiphany came. Standing there before his grandfather's clock, listening to his brother-in-law, it suddenly occurred to Wooly that maybe, just maybe, St. George's and St. Mark's and St. Paul's organized every day to be an everyday day, not because it made things easier to manage, but because it was the best possible means by which to prepare their fine young men in their care to catch the 6:42, so that they would always be on time for their meetings at 8. At the very moment that Wooly concluded the recollection of his epiphany, Billy reached the point in the story when Edmond Dantès, having successfully escaped from prison, was standing in the secret cave on the Isle of Monte Cristo
before a magnificent pile of diamonds, pearls, rubies, and gold.
You know what would be magnificent, Billy? You know what would be absolutely magnificent?
Marking his place, Billy looked up from his book.
What, Wooly? What would be absolutely magnificent?
A one-of-a-kind kind of day.
Sally. At last week's Sunday service, Reverend Pike read a parable from the Gospels in which Jesus and his disciples, having arrived in a village, are invited by a woman into her home. Having made them all comfortable, this woman, Martha, retreats into her kitchen to fix them something to eat. And all the while, she's cooking and generally seeing to everyone's needs by filling empty glasses and getting second helpings, her sister, Mary, is sitting at Jesus' feet. Eventually, Martha has had enough and she lets her feelings be known. Lord, she says, can't you see that my idler of a sister has left me to do all the work? Why don't you tell her to lend me a hand? Or something to that effect. And Jesus, he replies, Martha, you are troubled by too many things when only one thing is needful. And it is Mary who has chosen the better way. Well, I'm sorry, but if ever you needed proof that the Bible was written by a man, there you have it. I am a good Christian. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. I believe that Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son, was born of the Virgin Mary and suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, was buried, and on the third day rose again. I believe that having ascended to heaven, he will come again to judge the quick and the dead. I believe that Noah built an ark and herded every manner of living thing up the gangplank two by two before it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. I am even willing to believe that Moses was spoken to by a burning bush, but I am not willing to believe that Jesus Christ, our Savior, who at the drop of a hat would heal a leper or restore sight to the blind, would turn his back on a woman who was taking care of a household. So I don't blame him. Whom I blame is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and every other man who's served as priest or preacher since. From a man's point of view, the one thing that's needful is that you sit at his feet and listen to what he has to say, no matter how long it takes for him to say it or how often he's said it before. By his figuring, you have plenty of time for sitting and listening because a meal is something that makes itself. The manna, it falls from heaven, and with a snap of the fingers, the water can be turned into wine. Any woman who's gone to the trouble of baking an apple pie can tell you that's how a man sees the world. To bake an apple pie, you've first got to make the dough. You've got to cut the butter into the flour, gather it with a beaten egg and a few tablespoons of ice water, let it bind overnight. The next day, you've got to peel and core the apples, cut them into wedges, and toss them with cinnamon sugar. You've got to roll out the crust and assemble the pie. Then you bake it at 425 degrees for 15 minutes and 350 degrees for another 45. Finally, when supper's over, you carefully plate a slice and set it on the table where, in mid-sentence, a man will fork half of it into his mouth and swallow without chewing, so that he can get right back to saying what he was saying without the chance of being interrupted. And strawberry preserves? Don't you get me started on strawberry preserves. As young Billy pointed out so rightly, making preserves is a time-consuming venture. Just picking the berries takes you half a day. Then you have to wash and stem the fruit. You have to sterilize the lids and jars. Once you combine the ingredients, you have to set them on simmer and watch them like a hawk, never letting yourself stray more than a few feet from the stove to make sure they don't overcook. When they're ready, you pour the preserves, seal the jars, and lug them into the pantry one tray at a time. Only then can you start the process of cleaning up, which is a job in itself. And yes, as Duchess pointed out, the canning of preserves is a little old-fashioned, hearkening back to the era of root cellars and wagon trains. I suppose the very word preserves is bygone when compared to the blunt precision of jam. And as Emmett pointed out, it is, above all else, unnecessary. Thanks to Mr. Smucker, At the grocery, there are 15 varieties of jam selling for 19 cents a jar, season in and season out. In fact, jam has become so readily available, you can practically buy it at the hardware store. So yes, the making of strawberry preserves is time-consuming, old-fashioned, and unnecessary. Then why, you might ask, do I bother to do it? I do it because it's time-consuming. Whoever said that something worthwhile shouldn't take time? It took months for the Pilgrims to sail to Plymouth Rock. It took years for George Washington to win the Revolutionary War. And it took decades for the pioneers to conquer the West. Time is that which God uses to separate the idle from the industrious. For time is a mountain, and upon seeing its steep incline, the idle will lie down among the lilies of the field and hope that someone passes by with a pitcher of lemonade. What the worthy endeavor requires is planning, effort, attentiveness, and the willingness to clean up. I do it because it's old-fashioned. Just because something's new doesn't mean it's better, and often enough, it means it's worse. Saying please and thank you is plenty old-fashioned. Getting married and raising children is old-fashioned. Traditions, the very means by which we come to know who we are nothing if not old-fashioned. I make preserves in the manner that was taught to me by my mother, God rest her soul. She made preserves in the manner that was taught to her by her mother, and grandma made preserves in the manner that was taught to her by hers, and so on and so forth, back through the ages all the way to Eve, or at least as far as Martha. And I do it because it's unnecessary. For what is kindness but the performance of an act that is both beneficial to another and unrequired? There is no kindness in paying a bill. There is no kindness in getting up at dawn to slop the pigs or milk the cows or gather the eggs from the hen house. For that matter, there is no kindness in making dinner or in cleaning the kitchen after your father heads upstairs without so much as a word of thanks. There is no kindness in latching the doors and turning out the lights, or in picking up the clothes from the bathroom floor in order to put them in the hamper. There is no kindness in taking care of a household because your only sister had the good sense to get herself married and move to Pensacola. Nope, I said to myself while climbing into bed and switching off the light. There is no kindness in any of that. For kindness begins where necessity ends.
Duchess. Having come upstairs after supper, I was about to flop down on Emmett's bed when I noticed the smoothness of the covers. After freezing in place for a moment, I leaned over the mattress to get a closer look. There was no question about it. She had remade it. I thought I'd done a pretty good job, if I do say so myself, but Sally had done a better one. There wasn't a ripple on the surface. And where the sheet gets folded at the top of the blanket, there was a 4-inch-high rectangle of white running from one edge of the bed to the other, as if she'd measured it with a ruler, while at the base she had tucked in the covers so tightly that you could see the corners of the mattress through the surface of the blanket, the way you could see Jane Russell through the surface of her sweater. It was such a thing of beauty, I didn't want to disturb it until I was ready to go to bed. So I sat on the floor, leaned against the wall, and gave some thought to the Watson brothers as I waited for everyone else to fall asleep. Earlier that day, when I'd gotten back to the house, Wooly and Billy were still lying out on the grass. "How was your walk?" asked Wooly. "Rejuvenating," I replied. "What have you two been up to?" "Billy has been reading me some of the stories from Professor Abernathy's book." "Sorry I missed that. Which ones?" Billy was in the middle of running down the list when Emmett pulled into the drive. Speaking of stories, I thought to myself. In another moment, Emmett was going to emerge from his car a little worse for wear. He was certainly going to have a fat lip and some bruises. He might even have the beginnings of a shiner. The question was how he was going to explain them. Did he trip on a crack in the sidewalk? Did he tumble down a set of stairs? In my experience, the best explanations make use of the unexpected. Like, I was crossing the lawn of the courthouse admiring the sight of a whippoorwill perched on the branch of a tree when a football hit me in the face. With an explanation like that, your listener is so focused on the whippoorwill up in the tree, they never see the football coming. But when Emmett walked over and a wide-eyed Billy asked what had happened, Emmett said that he'd run into Jake Snyder while in town and Jake had hit him. Just like that. I turned to Billy, expecting an expression of shock or maybe outrage, but he was nodding his head and looking thoughtful. "Did you hit him back?" he asked after a moment. "No," said Emmett. "Instead, I counted to 10. Then Billy smiled at Emmett, and Emmett smiled right back. "Truly, Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Shortly after midnight, I poked my head into Wooly's room. From the sound of his breathing, I could tell that he was lost in his dreams. I crossed my fingers that he hadn't taken too much of his medicine before going to bed, since I was going to have to roust him soon enough. The Watson brothers were sound asleep too, Emmett flat on his back and Billy curled on his side. In the moonlight, I could see the kid's book on the foot of the bed. If he happened to stretch his legs, it might drop to the floor. So I moved it to the spot on the bureau where his mother's picture should have been. I found Emmett's pants hanging over the back of a chair, with all of its pockets empty. Tiptoeing around the bed, I squatted at the bedside table. The drawer wasn't more than a foot from Emmett's face, so I had to ease it open inch by inch. But the keys weren't there either. "Harumph," I said to myself. I'd already looked for them in the car and in the kitchen before coming upstairs. Where in the hell could he have put them? As I was mulling this over, the beam from a set of headlights swept across the room as a vehicle pulled into the Watsons' drive and rolled to a stop. Quietly, I headed down the hall and paused at the top of the stairs. Outside, I heard the door of the vehicle open. After a moment, there were footsteps on and off the porch. Then the door closed, and the vehicle drove away. When I was sure that no one had woken, I went down into the kitchen, opened the screen door, and stepped out onto the porch. In the distance, I could see the lights of the vehicle headed back up the road. It took me a moment to notice the shoebox at my feet with big black letters scrawled across the top. I may be no scholar, but I know my own name when I see it, even by the light of the moon. Getting down on my haunches, I gently lifted the lid, wondering what, in God's name, could be inside. Well, I'll be damned. 8. Emmett. When they pulled out of the driveway at 5:30 in the morning, Emmett was in good spirits. The night before, with the help of Billy's map, he had laid out an itinerary. The route from Morgan to San Francisco was a little over 1,500 miles. If they averaged 40 miles an hour for 10 hours a day, leaving time enough to eat and sleep, they could make the trip in 4 days. Of course, there was plenty to see between Morgan and San Francisco. As their mother's postcards attested, there were motor courts and monuments, rodeos and parks. If you were willing to drive out of your way, there were Mount Rushmore, Old Faithful, and the Grand Canyon. But Emmett didn't want to waste time or money on the journey west. The sooner they got to California, the sooner he could get to work. And the more money they had in hand when they got there, the better a house they would be able to buy. If they began frittering away what little they had while in transit, they'd have to settle for buying a marginally worse house in a marginally worse neighborhood, which, when the time came to sell, would result in a marginally worse profit. As far as Emmett was concerned, the faster they crossed the country, the better. Emmett's primary worry when he'd gone to bed had been that he wouldn't be able to rouse the others, that he'd waste the first hours of daylight getting them up and out the door. But he needn't have worried. When he rose at 5, Duchess was already in the shower, and he could hear Wooly humming down the hall.
Billy had gone so far as to sleep in his clothes, so he wouldn't have to get dressed when he woke. By the time Emmett took his place behind the wheel and retrieved his keys from above the visor, Duchess was already in the passenger seat, and Billy was sitting beside Wooly in the back with his map in his lap. And when shortly before dawn they turned out of the driveway, not one of them cast a backward glance. Maybe they all had reasons for wanting to make an early start, thought Emmett. Maybe they all were ready to be someplace else. As Duchess was sitting in front, Billy asked if he wanted to hold the map. When Duchess declined on the grounds that reading in cars made him queasy, Emmett felt a little relieved, recognizing that Duchess didn't always pay the closest attention to details, while Billy was practically born to navigate. Not only did he have his compass and pencils at the ready, he had a ruler so he could calculate mileage off the 1-inch scale. But when Emmett signaled a right-hand turn onto Route 34, he found himself wishing that Duchess had taken on the job after all.
"You don't need to switch on your signal yet," said Billy. "We need to go straight for a little longer."
"I'm turning onto Route 34, Emmett explained, "because that's the fastest way to Omaha."
"But the Lincoln Highway goes to Omaha."
Emmett pulled onto the shoulder and looked back at his brother.
"It does, Billy, but it takes us a little out of the way."
"A little out of the way of what?"
asked Duchess with a smile.
"A little out of the way of where we're going," said Emmett.
Duchess looked into the back seat.
"Just how far is it to the Lincoln Highway, Billy?"
Billy, who already had his ruler on the map, said it was 17.5 miles. Wooly, who had been quietly looking at the scenery, turned to Billy with an awakened curiosity.
"What's the Lincoln Highway, Billy? Is it a special highway?"
"It was the first highway to cross America."
"The first highway to cross America," repeated Wooly in awe.
"Come on, Emmett," prodded Duchess. "What's 17.5 miles?
"It's 17.5 miles, Emmett wanted to reply. "On top of the 130 that we're already going out of our way in order to take you to Omaha." But at the same time, Emmett knew that Duchess was right. The added distance wasn't much to speak of, especially given how disappointed Billy would be if he insisted on taking Route 34.
"All right," he said. "We'll go by way of the Lincoln Highway."
As he pulled back onto the road, he could almost hear his brother nodding in affirmation that this was a good idea. For the next 17.5 miles, no one said a word. But when Emmett took the right at Central City, Billy looked up from his map in excitement.
"This is it," he said. "This is the Lincoln Highway."
Billy began leaning forward to see what was coming, then looking over his shoulder to see what they'd passed. Central City may only have been a city in name, but having dreamed for months about the journey to California, Billy was taking satisfaction from the handful of restaurants and motels, pleased to find they were not unlike the ones on their mother's postcards. That he was headed in the wrong direction didn't seem to make much difference. Wooly was sharing in Billy's excitement, looking at the roadside services with new appreciation.
"So this road stretches from coast to coast?"
"It stretches almost from coast to coast," corrected Billy. "It goes from New York City to San Francisco."
"That sounds pretty coast to coast," said Duchess.
"Except that the Lincoln Highway doesn't begin or end at the water. It begins in Times Square and ends at the Palace of the Legion of Honor."
"Is it named for Abraham Lincoln?" Wooly asked.
"It is," said Billy. "And there are statues of him all along the way."
"All along the way?"
"Boy Scout troops raised money to commission them."
"There's a bust of Abraham Lincoln on my great-grandfather's desk," said Wooly with a smile. "He was a great admirer of President Lincoln."
"How long has this highway been around?" asked Duchess.
"It was invented by Mr. Carl G. Fisher in 1912.
"Invented?"
"Yes," said Billy, "invented. He believed the American people should be able to drive from one end of the country to the other. He built the first sections in 1913 with the help of donations."
"People gave him money to build it?"
asked Duchess in disbelief.
Billy nodded in earnest. "Including Thomas Edison and Teddy Roosevelt."
"Teddy Roosevelt?" exclaimed Duchess.
"Bully," said Wooly. As they made their way eastward, with Billy dutifully naming every town they passed, Emmett took satisfaction that at least they were making good time. Yes, the trip to Omaha was going to take them out of their way, but having gotten an early start, Emmett figured they could drop Duchess and Wooly at the bus station, turn the car around, and easily make Ogallala before dark. Maybe they'd even make it as far as Cheyenne. After all, at this point in June, they would have 18 hours of light. As a matter of fact, thought Emmett, if they were willing to drive 12 hours a day, and averaged 50 miles an hour, they could make the whole trip in under 3 days. But that's when Billy pointed to a water tower in the distance with the name Lewis painted across it.
Look, Duchess, it's Lewis. Isn't that the city where you lived?
You lived in Nebraska? Emmett asked, looking at Duchess.
For a couple of years when I was a kid, Duchess confirmed.
Then he sat up a little in his seat and began looking around with heightened interest.
Hey, he said to Emmett after a moment, can we swing by? I'd love to get a look at the place, you know, for old time's sake.
Duchess,
oh, come on, please. I know you said you wanted to be in Omaha by 8, but it seems like we've been making pretty good time.
We're 12 minutes ahead of schedule, said Billy,
after looking at his surplus watch.
There, see?
All right, said Emmett. We can swing by, but just for a look,
that's all I'm asking.
When they reached the edge of the city, Duchess took over the navigation, nodding at the passing landmarks.
Yes, yes, yes. There, take that left by the fire station.
Emmett took the left, which led into a residential neighborhood with fine houses on nicely groomed lots. After a few miles, they passed a high-steepled church and a park.
You take that next right, said Duchess.
The right led them onto a wide, curving road interspersed with trees.
Pull over up there.
Emmett pulled over. They were at the bottom of a grassy hill, on the top of which was a large stone building. 3 stories high, with turrets on either end. It looked like a manor.
Was this your house? Asked Billy.
No, said Duchess with a laugh. It's a school of sorts.
A boarding school? Asked Wooly.
More or less.
For a moment, they all admired its grandeur. Then Duchess turned to Emmett.
Can I go in?
For what?
To say hi.
Duchess, it's 6:30 in the morning.
If no one's up, I'll leave a note. They'll get a kick out of it.
A note for your teachers? Asked Billy.
Exactly. A note for my teachers. What do you say, Emmett? It'll only take a few minutes. 5 minutes tops.
Emmett glanced at the clock in the dash.
All right, he said. 5 minutes.
Grabbing the book bag at his feet, Duchess climbed out of the car and jogged up the hill toward the building. In the back seat, Billy began explaining to Wooly why he and Emmett needed to be in San Francisco by the 4th of July. Turning off the engine, Emmett stared through the windshield, wishing he had a cigarette. Duchess's 5 minutes came and went. Then another 5. Shaking his head, Emmett chastised himself for letting Duchess go into the building. No one drops in anywhere for 5 minutes, whatever the time of day. Certainly no one who liked to talk as much as Duchess. Emmett got out of the car and walked around to the passenger side. Leaning against the door, he looked up at the school, noting that it was made from the same red limestone that they had used to build the courthouse in Morgan. The stone probably came from one of the quarries in Cass County. In the late 1800s, it had been used to build city halls, libraries, and courthouses in every town for 200 miles. Some of the buildings were so similar in appearance that when you went from one town to the next, it felt like you hadn't gone anywhere at all. Even so, there was something that didn't seem quite right about this building. It took Emmett a few minutes to realize that what was odd was that there wasn't a prominent entrance. Whether it had originally been designed as a manor house or school, a building this grand would have had a fitting approach. There would have been a tree-lined drive leading up to an impressive front door. It occurred to Emmett that they must be parked at the back of the building. But why hadn't Duchess directed them to drive up to the front? And why had he taken the book bag?
"I'll be right back," he said to Billy and Wooly.
"Okay," they replied, without looking up from Billy's map. Climbing the hill, Emmett made his way toward a door that was in the center of the building. As he walked, he was feeling a growing sense of irritation, almost looking forward to the dressing down he would be giving Duchess once he found him, telling him, in no uncertain terms, that they didn't have time for this sort of nonsense, that his uninvited appearance was already an imposition, and that the trip to Omaha was taking them 2.5 hours out of their way, 5 hours when you accounted for there and back. But these thoughts went out of Emmett's head as soon as he saw the broken pane, the one closest to the doorknob. Easing the door open, Emmett stepped inside, shards of glass crunching under the soles of his boots. Emmett found himself in a large kitchen with 2 metal sinks, a 10-burner stove, and a walk-in refrigerator. Like most institutional kitchens, it had been put in order the night before, its counters cleared, its cabinets closed, and all of its pots hung on their hooks. The only sign of disorder, other than the broken glass, was in a pantry area at the other side of the kitchen, where several drawers had been pulled open and spoons were scattered on the floor. Passing through a swinging door, Emmett entered a paneled dining room with 6 long tables like you'd expect to find in a monastery. Adding to the religious aura was a large stained glass window that was casting patterns of yellow, red, and blue on the opposite wall. The window depicted the moment that Jesus, risen from the dead, displayed the wounds in his hands. Only in this depiction, the amazed disciples were accompanied by children. Exiting the dining room's main doors, Emmett stepped into a grand entrance hall. To his left was the impressive front door that he'd expected, while to his right was a staircase made of the same polished oak. Under different circumstances, Emmett would have liked to linger in order to study the carvings on the door panels and the balusters of the staircase. But even as he was noting the quality of the workmanship, he heard sounds of commotion coming from somewhere overhead. Taking the steps 2 at a time, Emmett passed over an additional scattering of spoons. On the 2nd floor landing, hallways led in opposite directions, but from the one on the right came the unmistakable sound of children in turmoil. So that's the way he went. The first door Emmett came to opened on a dormitory. While the beds were arranged in 2 perfect rows, their linens were in disarray, and they were empty. The next door led to a 2nd dormitory with 2 more rows of beds and more linens in disarray. But in this room, 60 boys in blue pajamas were clustered in 6 raucous groups, at the center of each of which was a jar of strawberry preserves. In some of the groups, the boys were dutifully taking turns, while in others they were fighting for access, stabbing their spoons into the jam and transferring the contents into their mouths as quickly as possible so they could get another crack at the jar before it was empty. For the first time, it occurred to Emmett that this wasn't a boarding school. It was an orphanage. As Emmett was taking in the disorder, a 10-year-old boy with glasses who had noticed him tugged at the sleeve of one of the older boys. Looking up at Emmett, the older boy signaled a peer. Without exchanging a word, the 2 advanced shoulder to shoulder in order to place themselves between Emmett and the others. Emmett raised both of his hands in peace. "I'm not here to bother you. I'm just looking for my friend, the one who brought the jam." The 2 older boys stared at Emmett in silence, but the boy with the glasses pointed in the direction of the hallway. "He went the way he came." Emmett left the room and doubled back to the landing. He was about to head down the stairs when from the opposite hallway, he heard the muted sound of a woman shouting, followed by the pounding of a fist on wood. Emmett paused, then proceeded to the hallway, where he found 2 doors with tilted chairs tucked under the knobs. The shouting and pounding were coming from behind the 1st one. "Open this door right this minute!" When Emmett removed the chair and opened the door, a woman in her 40s, wearing a long white nightgown, nearly fell into the hallway. Behind her, Emmett could see another woman sitting on a bed weeping.
How dare you?
The pounder shouted, once she had regained her footing. Emmett ignored her and went to the second door to remove the second chair. Inside this room was a third woman, kneeling beside her bed in prayer, and an older woman sitting peacefully in a high-backed chair smoking a cigarette.
Ah, she said when she saw Emmett. How good of you to open the door. Come in, come in.
As the older woman tamped out her cigarette in the ashtray that was in her lap, Emmett took a step forward uncertainly. But even as he did so, the sister from the first room came in behind him.
How dare you?
She shouted again.
Sister Bernice, said the older woman, why are you raising your voice at this young man? Can't you see that he is our liberator?
The weeping sister now came into the room, still in tears, and the older woman turned to address the one who was kneeling.
Compassion before prayers, Sister Ellen.
Yes, Sister Agnes.
Sister Ellen rose from her place beside the bed and took the weeping sister in her arms, saying, Hush, 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 while Sister Agnes turned her attention back to Emmett.
What is your name, young man?
Emmett Watson.
Well, Emmett Watson, perhaps you can illuminate us as to what has been transpiring here at St. Nicholas's this morning.
Emmett felt a strong inclination to turn and walk out the door, but his inclination to answer Sister Agnes was stronger.
I was driving a friend to the bus station in Omaha, and he asked me to stop. He said he used to live here.
All four sisters were looking at Emmett keenly now. The crying sister no longer crying, and the hushing sister no longer hushing. The shouting sister was no longer shouting, but she took a threatening step toward Emmett.
Who used to live here?
His name is Duchess.
Ha!
She exclaimed, turning to Sister Agnes.
Didn't I tell you we hadn't seen the last of him? Didn't I say that he would return some day to perpetrate some final act of mischief?
Ignoring Sister Bernice, Sister Agnes looked toward Emmett with an expression of gentle curiosity.
But tell me, Emmett, why did Daniel lock us in our rooms? To what end?
Emmett hesitated.
Well?
Demanded Sister Bernice. Shaking his head, Emmett gestured in the direction of the dormitories.
As best as I can tell, he got me to stop so that he could bring the boys some jars of strawberry jam.
Sister Agnes let out a sigh of satisfaction.
There. You see, Sister Bernice, what our little Daniel has returned to perpetrate is an act of charity.
Whatever Duchess was perpetrating, thought Emmett, this little diversion had already set them back 30 minutes, and he sensed that if he hesitated now, he might be stuck here for hours.
Well then, he said as he backed toward the door, if everything's all right—
No, wait, said Sister Agnes, extending her hand.
Once in the hallway, Emmett moved quickly to the landing. With the voices of the sisters rising behind him, he dashed down the staircase, back through the dining room, and out the kitchen door, feeling a general sense of relief. He was halfway down the hillside before he noticed that Billy was sitting on the grass with his backpack at his side and his big red book in his lap, while Duchess, Wooly, and the Studebaker were nowhere to be seen.
Where's the car?
Emmett said breathlessly when he reached his brother. Billy looked up from his book.
Duchess and Wooly borrowed it, but they're going to bring it back.
Bring it back after what?
After they go to New York.
For a moment, Emmett stared at his brother, at once dumbfounded and irate. Sensing that something was wrong, Billy offered his assurance.
Don't worry, he said. Duchess promised they'd be back by the 18th of June, leaving us plenty of time to get to San Francisco by the 4th of July.
Before Emmett could respond, Billy was pointing at something behind him.
Look, he said.
Turning, Emmett saw the figure of Sister Agnes descending the hill, the hem of her long black habit billowing behind her as if she were floating on air.
You mean the Studebaker?
Emmett was standing alone in Sister Agnes's office talking to Sally on the phone.
Yes, he said. The Studebaker.
And Duchess took it?
Yes.
There was silence on the other end of the line.
I don't understand, she said. Took it where?
To New York.
New York, New York?
Yes, New York, New York.
And you're in Lewis?
Nearly.
I thought you were going to California. Why are you nearly in Lewis? And why is Duchess on his way to New York?
Emmett was beginning to regret having called Sally. But what choice had he had?
Look, Sally, none of that matters right now. What matters is that I've got to get my car back. I called the depot in Lewis, and apparently an eastbound train stops there later today. If I catch it, I can beat Duchess to New York, retrieve the car, and be back in Nebraska by Friday. The reason I'm calling is that, in the meantime, I need someone to take care of Billy.
Then why didn't you say so?
After giving Sally directions and hanging up Sister Agnes's phone, Emmett looked out the window and found himself thinking of the day that he'd been sentenced. Before heading into the courthouse with his father, Emmett had taken his brother aside to explain that he had waived his right to a trial. He explained that while he had intended Jimmy no serious harm, he had let his anger get the best of him, and he was ready to accept the consequences for his actions. While Emmett was explaining this, Billy didn't shake his head in disagreement or argue that Emmett was making a mistake. He seemed to understand that what Emmett was doing was the right thing to do. But if Emmett was going to plead guilty without a hearing, then Billy wanted him to promise one thing.
What's that, Billy? Promise me that whenever you feel like hitting someone in anger, first you'll count to 10.
And not only had Emmett promised to do so, they had shaken on it. Nonetheless, Emmett suspected that if Duchess were there right now, 10 might not be a high enough number to do the trick. By the time Emmett entered the dining hall, it was filled with the clamor of 60 boys talking all at once. Any dining hall crowded with boys was likely to be loud, but Emmett guessed this one was louder than usual as they relived the events of the morning. The sudden appearance of a mysterious Confederate who delivered jars of jam after locking the sisters in their rooms. From his time in Salina, Emmett knew that the boys weren't simply reliving the events in service of their excitement. They were reliving the events in order to establish them in lore, to settle upon all the key particulars of this story that was sure to be told in the halls of the orphanage for decades to come. Emmett found Billy and Sister Agnes sitting beside each other in the middle of one of the long monastic tables. A half-eaten plate of French toast had been pushed aside to make room for Billy's big red book.
I should have thought, Sister Agnes was saying as she laid a finger on a page, that your Professor Abernathy would have included Jesus in place of Jason. For surely he was one of the most intrepid travelers of all. Don't you agree, William? Ah, here is your brother.
Emmett took the chair opposite Sister Agnes, since the chair opposite Billy was occupied by his backpack.
Can we offer you some French toast, Emmett? Or perhaps some coffee and eggs?
No, thank you, sister, I'm fine.
She gestured to the backpack.
I don't think you've had the opportunity to tell me where you two are headed when you chanced into our company.
Chanced into our company, thought Emmett with a frown.
We were just taking Duchess, or Daniel, and another friend to the bus station in Omaha.
Ah, yes, said Sister Agnes. I think you did mention that. But the trip to the station was just a detour, said Billy. We are actually on our way to California.
California?
Exclaimed Sister Agnes, looking at Billy. How exciting. And why are you headed to California?
So Billy explained to Sister Agnes about their mother leaving home when they were young, and their father dying of cancer, and the postcards in the box in the bureau, the ones their mother had mailed from 9 different stops along the Lincoln Highway on her way to San Francisco.
And that's where we're going to find her, concluded Billy.
Well, said Sister Agnes with a smile, that does sound like an adventure.
I don't know about an adventure, said Emmett. The reality is that the bank foreclosed on the farm. We needed to make a fresh start, and it seems sensible to do so in a place where I can find work.
Yes, of course, said Sister Agnes in a more measured manner. She studied Emmett for a moment, then looked at Billy. Are you finished with your breakfast, Billy? Why don't you clear your things? The kitchen is right over there.
Sister Agnes and Emmett watched as Billy placed his silverware and glass on his plate and carried them carefully away. Then she turned her attention back to Emmett.
Is something wrong?
Emmett was a little surprised by the question.
What do you mean?
A moment ago you seemed a little put out when I echoed your brother's enthusiasm over your journey west.
I suppose I'd rather you hadn't encouraged him.
And why is that?
We haven't heard from our mother in 8 years, and have no idea where she is. As you've probably sensed, my brother has a strong imagination, so when possible I try to help him steer clear of disappointments, rather than heap on cause for more.
As Sister Agnes studied Emmett, he could feel himself shifting in his chair. Emmett had never liked ministry. Half the time it seemed like a preacher was trying to sell you something you didn't need, and the other half he was selling you something you already had. But when it came to people of the cloth, Sister Agnes unnerved him more than most.
Did you happen to notice the window behind me?
She asked finally.
I did.
She nodded, then gently closed Billy's book. When I first came to St. Nicholas's in 1942, I found that window to have a rather mysterious effect on me. There was something about it that captured my attention, but in a manner I couldn't quite pin down. Some afternoons, when things were quiet, I would sit with a cup of coffee, about where you're sitting now, and stare at it, simply to take it in. Then one day I realized what it was that had been affecting me so. It was the difference between the expressions on the faces of the disciples and the faces of the children.
Sister Agnes turned a little in her chair so that she could look up at the window. Almost reluctantly, Emmett followed her gaze.
If you look at the faces of the disciples, you can tell that they remain quite skeptical about what they've just seen. Surely, they are thinking to themselves, this must be some kind of hoax or vision, for with our own eyes we witnessed his death on the cross, and with our own hands we carried his body into the tomb. But if you look at the faces of the children, there isn't a hint of skepticism. They look upon this miracle with awe and wonder, yes, but without disbelief.
Emmett knew that Sister Agnes was well-intentioned, and given that she was a woman in her 60s who had devoted her life not only in service to the church, but in service to orphans, Emmett knew when she began her story that she deserved his full attention. But as she spoke, Emmett couldn't help noting that the yellow, red, and blue patterns from the very window she was describing had moved from the wall to the surface of the table, marking the progress of the sun and the loss of another hour.
Then he went up the hill with Emmett's book bag and broke the window to the kitchen door. Like one of the boys in the orphanage, Billy was recounting the morning's events in a state of excitement as Sally maneuvered Betty through traffic.
He broke the window? Because the door was locked. And then he went into the kitchen and got a fistful of spoons and carried them upstairs to the dormitories.
What did he want with a fistful of spoons?
He wanted the spoons because he was bringing them your strawberry preserves.
Sally looked over at Billy with an expression of shock.
He gave them a jar of my strawberry preserves?
No, said Billy. He gave them six.
Isn't that what you said, Emmett?
Both Billy and Sally turned to Emmett, who was looking out the passenger side window.
That sounds about right, he replied without looking back.
I don't understand, said Sally, almost to herself.
Leaning forward over the steering wheel, she accelerated in order to pull around a sedan.
I only gave him six jars. They might have lasted him from now until Christmas. Why on earth would he hand over the whole batch to a bunch of strangers?
Because they are orphans, explained Billy.
Sally considered this.
Yes, of course, Billy. You're absolutely right. Because they are orphans.
As Sally nodded her head in acknowledgement of Billy's reasoning and Duchess's charity, Emmett couldn't help but note that she'd been plenty more indignant about the fate of her jam than she had been about the fate of his car.
There, said Emmett, pointing to the station.
In order to make the turn, Sally cut in front of a Chevy. When she skidded to a stop, the three of them climbed from the cab. But as Emmett was glancing at the entrance of the station, Billy went to the bed of the truck, grabbed his backpack, and began swinging it onto his back. Seeing this, Sally exhibited a moment of surprise. Then she looked toward Emmett with the narrowed eyes of castigation.
"You haven't told him?" she asked under her breath. "Well, don't expect me to."
Emmett took his brother aside. "Billy," he began, "you don't need to put your backpack on right now."
"It's okay," Billy said, while tightening the shoulder straps. "I can take it off when we get on the train."
Emmett got down on his haunches. "You're not coming on the train, Billy."
"What do you mean, Emmett? Why aren't I coming on the train?"
"It makes more sense for you to go with Sally while I get the car. But as soon as I've got it, I'm coming right back to Morgan to pick you up. It shouldn't take me more than a few days." But even as Emmett was explaining this, Billy was shaking his head.
"No," he said. "No, I can't go back with Sally, Emmett. We have already left Morgan, and we are on our way to San Francisco."
"That's true, Billy. We are on our way to San Francisco, but right now the car is on its way to New York." When Emmett said this, Billy's eyes opened wide with revelation.
"New York is where the Lincoln Highway begins," he said. "After we take the train and find the Studebaker, we can drive to Times Square and start our journey from there."
Emmett looked to Sally for support. She took a step forward and put a hand on Billy's shoulder.
"Billy," she said in her no-nonsense tone, "you are absolutely right."
Emmett closed his eyes. Now it was Sally he was taking aside.
"Sally," he began, but she cut him off. "Emmett, you know that there is nothing I would rather do than keep Billy at my side for another 3 days. As God is my witness, I would be happy to keep him for another 3 years. But he has already spent 15 months waiting for you to return from Salina. And in the meanwhile, he's lost his father and his home. At this juncture, Billy's place is at your side, and he knows it. And I imagine by now, he thinks that you should know it too."
What Emmett actually knew was that he needed to get to New York and find Duchess as quickly as possible, and that having Billy along wasn't going to make the job any easier. But in one important respect, Billy had been right. They had already left Morgan. Having buried their father and packed their bags, they'd put that part of their lives behind them. It would be something of a comfort for both of them to know that whatever happened next, they wouldn't have to go back. Emmett turned to his brother.
"All right, Billy. We'll go to New York together."
Billy nodded in acknowledgement that this was the sensible thing to do. After waiting for Billy to retighten the straps on his pack, Sally gave him a hug, reminding him to mind his manners and his brother. Then, without giving a hug to Emmett, she climbed in her truck. But once she had turned the ignition, she beckoned him to her window.
"There's one more thing," she said.
"What's that?"
"If you want to chase your car to New York, that's your own business. But I have no intention of spending the next few weeks waking up in the middle of the night in a state of worry. So a few days from now, you need to give me a call and let me know that you're safe."
Emmett began to express the impracticality of Sally's request. That once in New York, their focus would be on finding the car. That he didn't know where they'd be staying, or whether they'd have access to a phone. "He didn't seem to have any trouble finding the means to call me at 7 this morning so I could drop whatever I was doing and drive all the way to Lewis. I have no doubt that in a city as big as New York, you'll be able to find another telephone and the time to use it."
"Okay," said Emmett. "I'll call."
"Good," said Sally. "When?"
"When what?"
"When will you call?"
"Sally, I don't even—"
"Friday, then. You can call me on Friday at 2:30.
Before Emmett could respond, Sally put the truck in gear and pulled to the depot's exit, where she idled, waiting for a break in the traffic. Earlier that morning, when they'd been preparing to leave the orphanage, Sister Agnes had bestowed on Billy a pendant on a chain, saying it was the medallion of Christopher, the patron saint of travelers. When she turned to Emmett, he worried that she was about to bestow a medallion on him, too. Instead, she said there was something she wanted to ask him. But before doing so, she had another story to tell. The story of how Duchess had come into her care. One afternoon in the summer of 1944, she said,
a man of about 50, had appeared at the orphanage door with a scrawny little 8-year-old at his side. Once the man was alone with Sister Agnes in her office, he explained that his brother and sister-in-law had died in a car crash, and that he was the boy's only surviving relative. Of course, he wanted nothing more than to care for his nephew, especially at such an impressionable age. But as an officer in the armed forces, he was due to ship out for France at the end of the week, and he didn't know when he would return from the war, or, for that matter, if he would return at all. Now, I didn't believe a word this man had to say. Never mind that his unkempt hair was hardly befitting an officer in the armed forces, and that he had a lovely young girl waiting in the passenger seat of his convertible car. It was plain enough that he was the boy's father. But it is not my calling to concern myself with the duplicity of unscrupulous men. It is my calling to concern myself with the welfare of forsaken boys. And let there be no doubt about it, Emmett, young Daniel was forsaken. Yes, his father reappeared 2 years later to reclaim Daniel when it suited him to do so, but Daniel didn't know to expect that. Most of the boys who come into our care are truly orphans. We have boys whose parents died together of influenza or in fires, whose mothers died in childbirth, and fathers died at Normandy. And it is a terrible trial for these children who must come of age without the love of their parents. But imagine becoming an orphan not by calamity, but by your father's preference, by his determination that you have become an inconvenience. Sister Agnes let that sink in for a moment. I have no doubt that you are angry with Daniel for taking liberties with your car, but we both know that there is goodness in him, a goodness that has been there from the beginning, but which has never had the chance to fully flourish. At this critical time in his life, what he needs more than anything else is a friend who will stand reliably at his side, a friend who can steer him clear of folly and help him find the way to fulfilling his Christian purpose.
Sister, you said you were going to ask me something. You didn't say you were going to ask something of me.
The nun studied Emmett for a second, then smiled. You are absolutely right, Emmett. I am not asking you this. I'm asking it of you.
I have someone to watch over already, someone who is my own flesh and blood, and who is an orphan in his own right.
She looked at Billy with an affectionate smile, but then turned back to Emmett with undiminished intent. Do you count yourself a Christian, Emmett?
I'm not the church-going sort.
But do you count yourself a Christian?
I was raised to be one.
Then I imagine you know the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yes, sister, I know the parable, and I know that a good Christian helps a man in need.
Yes, Emmett, a good Christian shows compassion toward those who are in difficulty, and that is an important part of the parable's meaning. But an equally important point that Jesus is making is that we do not always get to choose to whom we should show our charity. When Emmett had come to the end of his driveway shortly before dawn, he had turned onto the road knowing that he and Billy were unencumbered, free of any debts or obligations as they began their life anew. And now, having traveled just 60 miles from home, headed in the wrong direction, he had made 2 promises in as many hours. Once the traffic finally subsided and Sally took a left out of the station, Emmett expected her to turn and wave. But leaning forward over her wheel, Sally punched the gas, Betty backfired, and they both headed west without a glance in his direction. Only as they sped out of sight did Emmett realize he didn't have any money.